Good afternoon. You're listening to KPULP 104.7 FM. I'm here with Charlie and Charlie from the USS Hector. How you doing, Charlie?
Hey, thanks, Jeff. Yeah, Charlie Meter and I are part of the USS Hector Association, and we're privileged to be here to share with you about our ship, its history, and to bring awareness to the community, the history of the ship, and also this is kind of a prelude and honor to do this coming with Memorial Day coming up on Monday. We thought that for listener enjoyment, if you'd like, if you got some questions of us, maybe about the Hector, Hector's history, or maybe something about Navy life, if the listener would like to call in, is this area code 831?
Yeah.
768-9412. If you'd like to call in a question, we're going to mix the call-in questions along with some more sea stories and background and history. And, of course, we only got one line, so first come, first serve. Some of you may have to wait a little bit. That was 831-768-9412. So while we're waiting for a call, I was thinking, I got one sea story here from one of our actually, this is one of the plank owners wrote this in, Millard G. Mann, and it comes from the Hector Herald. It's Raisin Jack in the After Fire Room. I had heard of Raisin Jack, but had never made any. I got the recipe from a shipmate and decided to give it a try while we were anchored in Saipan in 45. I went to one of the cooks and who had access to the supplies, and after promising him a gallon of the finished product, in exchange, he gave me a sealed gallon can of raisins and a quarter pound of yeast. I got a 10-gallon oak water keg and put the keg and all the ingredients in the uptake room where the temperature was about 120 degrees. I put the raisins and the yeast in, added water, and left the room for the raisins to swell a bit and covered the whole thing with a pillowcase. It was moved to the corner of the room and covered with a large stack of canvas. Hopefully no one would go into to the trouble of removing the canvas in the event the brewing smell was noticed. Needless to say, at 120 degrees, it shortened the brewing time considerably. After it stopped working, we strained it and put it in gallon jugs. And again, I provided one to the friendly cook. We ended up with about 5 gallons of fine home brew in all, after the cook got his share. And we had plenty of party time in the aft fire room. A couple of pitchers full of ice filled with Raisin Jack, and the party was on. The brew was tasty and was quite a kick. Wilma Wyatt, my wife of 61 years, went to heaven last year, leaving my house and my heart pretty empty. I've been a Baptist preacher for the past 53 years, which goes to show how the Lord can change a life. Now you know the rest of the story. Reverend Mann, making Raisin Jack.
That's right. He was an old plank owner, and like I say, I met him, and he told me he was the first chaplain they had on Hector's Association before Ford.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He said he was the preacher before Ford.
Yeah, we have a Hector Association chaplain, and they write the chaplain's corner for the on our website.
Yeah, we have a new one now since Francis wants to sort of.
He's kind of semi-retired there.
He wants to become like I hope to be someday, an ex historian, because I have a new boy to take over for me.
Yeah, I'm young Padawan.
Yeah, he's young Padawan.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting, and I remember Francis Ford had a few stories to tell, too, when we were young rowdy days, huh?
Yeah.
Well, did you ever become a shellback, and what's a shellback?
I don't know what a shellback was. I got a card. A fellow was supposed to be sending me his shellback award. I haven't got it. I actually don't know what a shellback is.
Well, my father-in-law, Howard Kunkel, he was on the USS Menifee in World War II, and he crossed the equator. And there was a hazing ceremony that It was traditional among sailors when you crossed the equator, you became a shellback. And
that's, yeah.
And that what it was, a big, long ceremony, and anybody that hadn't crossed the equator before, didn't matter if you were enlisted or officer,
you were
called a polywog.
Yeah.
And did you hear some of the stories about the guys that had been shellbacked?
Oh, yeah, some of the deals, but they went through.
What kind of things did they go through?
Well, actually, the only thing I know is I've seen the pictures. No one, I really didn't know. Well, this kid next door to me, he crossed the equator, but he didn't say anything too much about it, except he said his butt was sore.
Well, my father-in-law said that had to crawl around on that hard deck, that steel deck, and of course it had anti-skid on it, so that kind of rubbed your knees and hands a little raw, and they would paddle you.
Yeah.
When you walk by and throw things on you and dunk you in the water. And then I guess one of the big things was they got the fattest chief on board the ship sat down there, and he was considered King Neptune.
Yeah, King Neptune, yeah.
Yeah, and you had to kiss his belly, and it was all greased up with axle grease. Things sailors do for entertainment. But, did you ever have to do any mess cooking?
No, I didn't. I was lucky enough because that bosun mate liked me well, and he kept me out of the mess deck.
Most of the new guys that reported on, enlisted guys, had to go down to the galley and work anywhere from a month to 3 months, do their share of helping to serve the Hector crew mess cooking. And you might be just cleaning tables or mopping floors or
serving food.
You might be serving food. I happened to be lucky enough to know one of the storekeepers that worked for the head cook. So I got to go down and do my mess cooking, helping with stacking stores. And what was nice about that is that I always liked the canned grapefruit sections, so I usually could end up with a can of grapefruit sections to go back with to eat, you know. That was kind of considered a luxury to have that.
And the one I liked was the guy who used to serve butter. Remember, with that fork with a bent tongue and a knife? He'd pick up a square of butter with that fork. They'd bend all the tines on the fork, one down, and he'd touch a piece square of butter, put it on your mess tray, and take a knife and hit it and make the butter fall off. That was a job I thought would be pretty good.
Sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, but it was very much work compared to standing there and, you know, you had a piece of liver there, and you ask the guy, you want a liver? No.
Well, if you look on the website, there's a link to YouTube for actual movies that were supplied, and there is one movie that shows the Hector being refueled underway. And did you ever go through any refueling?
Yeah, well, back in 1949, when I was a deck ape crane operator, we had the Uvalde come alongside, and we fueled her, and we also took stores from her back onto the Hector. And the Uvalde left, and a tin can come alongside. And they hooked up the fuel line to the tin can, and when you got through, they were supposed to shut the fuel off, and the ship receiving the fuel was supposed to cap the end of the hose. These dirty SO so-and-so didn't, so when that hose swung back, covered the whole boat deck with that damn old crude oil. We had to go out and clean it off.
Made for being a little slippery, too, huh?
No, just slippery and stinky. And then they give you, what, soap and water to cut that stuff with? Boy, you had to have a lot of elbow grease.
I can imagine what things would be like right now in this day and age with any kind of fuel spill.
Yeah.
Coast Guard would be all over us.
They did have you locked up.
Yeah. Well, I remember we did an underway refueling in 72, and we did it with the USS Camden. And that's one of the videos that's on the website link. And that's a Sacramento-class supply ship.
Yeah.
It was stationed out of Bremerton, and we were doing it down in the South China Sea, along out of South Vietnam, because we had to do a kind of a lengthy stay. I think we stayed there probably about 4 months, and we would ship in and out of the harbor of Da Nang, supplying, doing repair work to the fleet there. I remember that one of the ships that we were repairing was the USS Higbee. And if the listeners want, you can go to the USS Higbee, it's H-I-G-B-E-E, their website. They got some really interesting photos tied up alongside the USS Hector of their gun mount. Their after gun mount had been hit by a bomb from a MiG, and it's kind of a famous story. And if you know, if you guys that are Navy history like to read about that, it's pretty interesting. My personal experience was is that being the only guy sitting around the damage control shop, somebody elected me to be fire watch down inside there while they were cutting and welding, trying to patch the Higbee back together because the whole fantail back end had been blown up. And they were trying to get it seaworthy enough to get it over to the Philippines to put it in dry dock. So I wound up going down there because I was sitting around with nothing to do. Got to be fire watch, and after I got down inside the compartments, there was a hole, a bomb hole that went right through the whole fantail of the ship, through the gun mount, and all the way down through the bottom. And so there was water that was floating up inside the compartment, and about 6 inches of fuel oil floating all around. And what really made me nervous was here they were welding and cutting, and was dropping hot slag down into the fuel oil. And that fuel oil would start taking off and getting on fire. That's why you're the fire watch, Atkins. Run around and put that fire out. And I'm telling you, it was, you know, I thought, okay, this is kind of exciting, but where's the hole that I might fall down in, you know? And I couldn't see it. So I had to feel for it and get over and get the fire out. But probably the thing that made me most nervous was the live ammunition that was laying around in that fuel oil that didn't want that fire to take off.
And those pictures were never published back here in the States.
Actually, they're on the USS Higbee
website.
Yeah,
but I mean in a newspaper, like...
Oh, no.
No,
nobody knew about
no,
that.
No, nobody knew about that.
That was something that they just kept from the public, I think.
And that was the same way up in Korea when the Evans got its... I think it was the Evans, wasn't it? Got its bow blown off by a mine. That was never put in the paper.
No, they don't want the public to know that stuff when it happens.
Know about that.
But anyway, so while we were doing that, we were going in and out of harbor, and we would go out and we'd need to refuel because we couldn't go to any kind of fueling station there in Da Nang area. Quite an interesting experience there. Now, when you were at Incheon, did you see any live action there at all?
The only live action we seen was when the Jersey and Juneau and the Mo was over behind the island firing over our head into Seoul. That's the only thing we had.
Well, they,
boom, you know, boom, boom. Flare up. That's the only thing we had.
Did they were softening them up before they sent the Marines in?
No, this was on when they already made the Incheon landing. They was heading towards Seoul. And they were shelling Seoul from the Incheon Harbor over the island. It was an island. And then we were here, and the beach was here, and they were over here firing over us into Seoul. And they said the reason they didn't come in was the draft.
Yeah.
Tides and so forth.
Huh. Yeah, we had several ships tie up next to us. They were running up along the DMZ and shelling into the jungles. And yeah. I guess they'd get in these firefights with the Viet Cong, and several of them came back down. They would have missile holes in them and bomb holes in them, and we'd patch them up. And if the story is right, that's why these are sea stories, but I was told that we actually used our reefers as placed the whole bodies in the body bags. Not a very good thought, but that the Hector did all kinds of services. And did you ever have to do shore patrol duty?
No, I was lucky.
How'd you get out of that? I thought everybody had to do that.
No.
You must have had a good in with the chief.
Well, I don't know. My buddies got it. I didn't get it. Most likely they put me on shore patrol. They'd have to come. I don't know. They just never got to me. And like I say, that's one thing I didn't volunteer for. I know one time I volunteered, and it cost me 4 years, so I didn't volunteer for anything else.
You learned, huh?
I learned.
Yeah.
Very well.
Well, I got stuck with it just about every port.
Yeah.
My division commander and I didn't get along that well, so he liked to have me out of the area quite frequently, so a good way to get rid of me was assign me to shore patrol. So just about every port we went to, I was assigned to shore patrol. And I had some pretty interesting experiences down in the Philippines in Longapo City doing shore patrol there. That was kind of like when I was there, it's kind of like still like the old Wild West down there. I remember we get off the base there and they had a money exchange outside the main gate, and Filipino bodyguards and police officers are running around with Thompson machine guns and 45s and machetes, and it was pretty wild back then. But shore patrol, I grew to like it eventually because I didn't have to be around the division commander that much.
I know a kid next door, he was on the Delta, and he did quite a bit of time in the Philippines. He said the only semi he seen while he was in the Philippines was in Subic Bay, and that was a Sam McGill beer truck hauling beer into the base.
It had to be the good beer, too.
Yeah, it had to
be
the good.
They made two kinds.
Yeah.
You get the wrong wrong Manila beer, you were in trouble.
Oh, you were in trouble, he said, yeah. But he said that's the only semi he seen on hauling beer into the base.
Well, let's see. And one of the other things you can see on the website is a real Navy smoker. What's a smoker?
Oh, that's they'd get together in sort of a recreation. They'd have boxing, and some guy would get up there with a guitar and thought he was Roy Rogers singing or something, you know. And another guy would play a piano. He'd get up there, just more of entertainment, and they always had some nice cold beer after you took the rust off the can. And just a lot of fun. Get off the ship for one thing, and that was about it. Oh, now and then they'd have some Japanese dancers get up there and wiggle around, do some of their native dances and so forth. And
yeah.
And the men get up there and they'd boo them, but when the girls come up, they'd cheer them on.
Well, sure. Haven't seen a real girl for
a long
time.
No, haven't seen a real girl in a long time.
Yeah. Well, I got another short Hector story from one of the sailors that wrote in, Glenn Hoffman. He was a quartermaster first class in 1983 and 1985. Mm-hmm. And he calls it one more good sea story, the captain's drawers. And it was Westpac 1983. It was pretty uneventful coming back from the Arabian Gulf en route to Diego Garcia. Well, even that much was uneventful. The real excitement started in the mid-watch on Hector when the officer of the deck was Lieutenant Hall, had an unusual assortment of deck personnel located on the bridge in various locations to keep watch. And about 2 hours into the watch, the eyes were getting heavy, and the sways and general rolls of the old Hector steamed in the early morning hours. Lieutenant Hall came over to the quartermaster's table and plopped down on her elbows and leaned against the table. I was so out of it myself, my eyes were closed at the same time, and they must not have opened. I suspect that Lieutenant Hall, until, I guess I shouldn't have used the name, huh? Until all of a sudden, there was a very short, loud report of a collision alarm. Now everybody woke up. At that moment, I popped, and Tall and Lieutenant Hall did also, striking our foreheads together. We both saw stars. Before I could recover my wits, the captain, George Chappell, came clamoring onto the bridge wearing, and to our disbelief and complete amazement, a pair of boxer shorts with little red hearts on them. We were laughing so hard. We were just in relief when we found out on the flying bridge the forward lookout had also fallen asleep standing up next to the alarm panel located there and fell over and set him off. The mid-watches weren't quite the same after that. That's what you get for sleeping on duty. Now, well, let's see. I'm trying to think of here. Uh-oh, here comes. How about, tell me about your story of being in the gun mount and setting fuses.
Oh, when I was a deck ape, I mean, up on the boat deck, I got up into the, I came up and I was put into the 5-inch gun turret as a fuse setter. A fuse setter was the one they would radio you and tell you how to set the fuse to a time after it would let the projectile would automatically explode. Well, the whole time I was in there, all the projectiles were set manually by the gunner's mate. So I just sat there and reported in that I was there. The bridges say, aye, aye. They'd fire the deal off. And we were firing away, and all at once, we come up, and the guy put the powder case in. He put a big old, about 3-foot brass powder can full of powder, and the projectile man would put the projectile into the breech. Well, then they would ram it. They'd take and shove it up into the barrel, and then they would fire it off. And when it was fired off, the breech would come back, bringing back the powder case, and the hot shellman, they had a hole in, cut out in the bottom of the turret. He would take his glove, and he'd knock that brass powder case out through the bottom of the turret. The turret was locked. This time, it rammed, come back, and it didn't fire. And there was a projectile and a powder case in the breech. First thing the gun captain knows that, he yelled, "Ban the turret." I was sitting down below the trainer. He sat here on the seat. I sat down here on the seat. When he said, "Ban the turret," I got out, crawled, maybe 4 or 5 feet to where that hole was in the bottom of the turret. I went out head first onto the deck. I crawled for about 20 feet and got up and finally got up and went up and sat down by the smokestack. Then they called the gunner's crews in. They played around. They fired it off. If that thing would have let loose while we was in that turret, it would have been nothing but a ball of fire. And I wouldn't have been here today, or my buddies wouldn't have been either. So every time I think, that sort of makes you want to think. It was scary. But, and on the deck was these empty projector, the powder cases, and there was some 40 cases sitting around there. Went back in the turret, fired again, boom, the way she went. So that was quite a deal.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of potentially dangerous things aboard a ship, and it probably still is. You don't really get California OSHA approved construction to work with. You have to pretty much make do with space and distance, and for the mission.
Yeah.
I got a little story that I like to tell about my buddy Dan McGraw. Dan McGraw's he was just a fireman back then when we were on board, and I call it Dan McGraw made the chief's move. And when you were a chief petty officer, they pretty much run the Navy. So you don't have to do a. You sit back and let all the the underlings do it, and the chiefs make sure it gets done right. But they're a hard bunch to keep happy, yeah. Don't you think?
Well, yeah, they are. I don't know. Some were good. Boy, some went by the book, plus they wrote their own book. And they said, jump, boy, and you were supposed to jump.
When the chief said jump, you better jump.
Yeah, do something. Right. Even if it's wrong, do something.
Well, old Dan, his job was assigned to cutting the deck rails off. We were replacing them because they were, pardon me, I stutter once in a while. Jeff will cut that part out. Dan was cutting these deck railings off, and these two chiefs were outside the boiler shop sitting there, and Dan came by and says, "Hey, chiefs, you might want to move because I'm running a cutting torch here." And they didn't want no firemen telling them they had to move. So they were just sitting in those chairs. He says, "Go ahead, son, just keep doing your work." So Dan was going along with his, got his goggles on. He's cutting these rails, And, of course, he's shooting. The sparks are going out over the side of the ship. And he gets a little closer to where the chiefs are, and he's running out of gas line. So he doesn't understand why the gas line is hung up. So he gives it a little jerk. We did that. I guess they didn't tie the oxygen and acetylene bottles down very well. And the oxygen bottle fell over on its side. And, of course, that knocked the gauge loose. And, of course, when the gauge loose, it made this loud hissing sound. And, of course, everybody knows when an oxygen bottle loses its top, it takes off like a missile. Well, those old chiefs thought that oxygen bottle was taken off, and they fell over backwards on their chairs trying to get away from that area. And, boy, they were cursing Dan something fierce. But I walked around a corner when that happened, and I tell you, it was the funniest thing I ever saw. Dan finally takes his goggles off, looks around, and wonders, well, what's happening?
I'll tell you, when they had on the Hector there, remember the old life jackets, the rubber life jackets with the pull cap?
Oh, yeah.
They had those little...
Went around your waist and...
Yeah, and had that little canister you pull in it.
Yeah, CO2 canister.
A little CO2, yeah. Well, they had a deal on there. If anyone's caught taking those out of the life jackets, they're going to go up and see the old man. The guys go around and take those, and they went down to the carpenter shop, and they got a piece of wood, and they put it on this rail, take another piece of wood with a nail and a hammer and hit it, and see how far they could shoot them out on the side of the ship. And they said if they caught anybody doing that again, is going to go up and see the old man, because all the life jackets didn't have any of those CO2 bottles in them.
You know, we used to take those out of the, the boats on the boat deck. We used to have to replace those.
Yeah.
And I remember our crew, we wound up, those were bigger canisters.
Yeah.
But we wound up making, we welded together some tubing.
Yeah.
And put an actuator on that. And screwed one of those big bottles on there, and it made a nice little rifle.
Yeah.
And we used welding rod for a shot. So we go over the side of the ship and shoot fish.
Yeah.
With that, and it's a nice CO2 pellet gun, you know. Trying to snag dinner. I know when we were. Oh, I know what I wanted to do. I wanted to read the 1 year anniversary USS Hector. Birthday menu, and when it became its 1 year birthday was February 7th, 1945, and the crew celebrated the. I thought it was kind of interesting. The listeners might want to hear what the crew had for lunch. Birthday lunch was turkey soup and stuffed olives and roast young Tom turkey, giblet gravy, candied sweet potatoes. Sage dressing. This sounds like it came out of the officer's mess, not the enlisted. Asparagus tips.
Boy.
Buttered peas. Baked spiced ham. Thousand Island dressing with vegetable salad. Glazed carrots. This was some party.
Yeah.
Parker House rolls. Now, what in the world is that? Butter, iced beverage, ice cream, mince pie, and to top it all off, cigars and cigarettes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that in before I go on to... you got any other good sea stories for us?
Not particular.
No?
Did some crazy things, but can't remember them all.
I don't know if anybody's listening. We haven't got a call in yet, have we?
No.
Well, if you are listening and you want to call in, ask us a question. It's area code 831-768-9412. And if you want to follow along, it's www.usshector.com. I had one other little story to tell. When we were out there off the Da Nang Harbor there, we were in a ship's nest. What we had to do is we pulled in real early in the morning, because we'd have to go out at nighttime. They were afraid of somebody swimming in and putting a mine on the side of the ship. So we'd pull in about 5 in the morning and start tying up ships alongside, and then they'd drop the dive boat, would circle around the whole nest in the ship and drop hand grenades in the water in case somebody was swimming in there with a mine. So that's the dive boat was doing that all day long. So about Oh, every 5 minutes, the whole ship would shake, and you hear this big thump, you know, like that. And there was a grenade going. And so we did this, you know, after the first, third month, you're really getting bored. You know, you hear thump, thump, and then, of course, at nighttime, we'd pull out. But so I guess one of the Army guys thought it was kind of funny that he'd play a joke on us. So he got one of the local girls near the base, I guess, and he got on a Zodiac and drove out to the Hector Nest out in the middle of the bay. And when he got close to the ship, well, she didn't have a stitch of clothes on. Well, I think all the ships stopped work right then. And they come clamoring out of the ship. They couldn't control anybody from doing work because these guys hadn't seen a girl in I don't know how long. So he made one pass around all the ships with that naked girl on the bow of that Zodiac boat, and they headed off like he was going back to the base. Well, by that time, this is a family show, huh? Okay, I'll keep it. anyway, so he's going away, and he turns around to come back. Well, by then, all the crews had come out on the main deck. Cameras, binoculars, and everything that. Well, she'd done put her clothes back on, and he laughed. He was laughing and waving as he went around. That was playing a joke on the Hector sailors. So I'm sure some of the guys remember that.
When I was in there, we couldn't do things like that.
Oh, you were in the real Navy?
Yeah.
I think that's probably pretty close to what we had. Did you have anything else you wanted to share, Charlie?
Well, not really. Oh, I have one here. When I took over the historian for the Hector back in 1988, my buddies asked me to take it over for 1 year. Well, I'm still at it, except now I got myself a young man who volunteered to give me a hand. Well, eventually, he's going to have it all by himself, but I'll still help him. And when I took over the job, I made out one thing I said I was going to do. I'm going to get a complete history from the Hector from the day she was commissioned until she was decommissioned. Well, it took me 10 years. I got it sitting right here. I have a book telling every place the Hector went from 1944 to 1987. And I'm sure glad of that. I'd like to thank all my old shipmate buddies sending me the information to do it. If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have this book. So thank you, buddies.
Yeah, I thank you, too. I kind of wanted to kind of wind down, and I have a poem I wanted to read that was submitted by our second chaplain, Padre Francis Ford. And the author is unknown, but it's titled Just a Common Sailor. He was getting old and paunchy, and his hair was falling fast. He sat around the Legion telling stories of the past, of a war that he had fought in and the deeds that he had done. In his exploits with his buddies, they were heroes, every one. And sometimes to his neighbors, his tales became a joke. All his Legion buddies listened, for they knew of what he spoke. But we will hear his tales no longer, for old Bill has passed away. And the world's a little poor, for a sailor died today. He'll not be mourned by many, just his children and his wife, for he lived a quiet, ordinary, uneventful life. He held a job to raise a family, going quiet on his own way, so the world won't know he's passing, though a sailor died today. When politicians leave the earth, their bodies lie in state, while thousands note their passing and proclaim that they were great. Papers tell their whole life stories from the time that they were young, but the passing of a sailor goes unnoticed and unsung. In the greatest contribution to the welfare of our land, a guy who breaks his promise and cons his fellow man, or is the ordinary fellow who in times of war and strife goes off to serve his country and offers up his life. A politician's stipend and the style in which he lives is sometimes disproportionate to the service that he gives, while an ordinary sailor who offered up his all is paid off with a medal and perhaps a pension small. It's so easy to forget them, for it was so long ago that the old bills of our country went to battle, but we know it was not the politician with their compromise employees who won for us the freedom that our country now enjoys. Should you find yourself in danger with the enemy at hand, would you want a politician with his ever-shifting stand, or would you want a sailor who has sworn to defend his home, his kin, his country, to fight until the end? He was just a common sailor, and his ranks were growing thin, but his presence should remind us he may need his like again. For when countries are in conflict, then we find the sailor's part is to clean up all the troubles that the politicians start. If we cannot do him honor while he's here to hear the praise, then at least give him homage at the ending of his days. Perhaps a simple headline in a paper that should say, "Our country is in mourning, for a sailor died today." And I dedicate that to my father-in-law, Howard Gunkel. He was World War II USS Menifee.
Nice job, Charlie. We're going to cut away, and we'll be right back. You're listening to KPULP 104.7 FM.
Gaze upon your silent shores and reminisce that sweet embrace. seeds of ginger. As New York City walls closed in, I long for the touch of an island. Molokai, Molokai, sweet home. So to rest your weary eyes, I've missed your smiles and lullabies in the evening time. It's been so long since I've been home. I miss the morning sunrise and the countryside. So far to find my way. This time I think I'll stay with an island. Molokai, Molokai, sweet home. Ooh. A few evening breeze tonight. Molokai, I'm longing for your laughter. I'll gaze upon your silent shores and reminisce that sweet embrace of ginger. As New York City walls closed in, I long for the touch of an
thank you.